It might seem like child's play to us. Cartoonist Bob Eckstein tells us how people have been making snowmen for centuries.
It is one of the most recognizable non-religious icons and symbols in the world.
Coming up, we'll learn the history of the snowman. Guides from Rome offer tips for visiting the Vatican, including seeing its art treasures.
VIPs would come to see the Pope, and he would show them his collection.
Try to do a little peek in the Pinacoteca. Very few people go there.
Guides from France remind us that you need to twist the bottle, not the cork, when you open champagne, so it doesn't explode all over everybody.
What you really want to do is just make it burp. You want to make it sigh.
And revisit the Scottish rituals for greeting the new year that promise you friendship and good luck.
You have to have a piece of black coal, a wee piece of cake, and a wee bottle of whiskey.
Come celebrate with us in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. What kind of year do you expect lies ahead? Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, we'll remind you of a few time-tested traditions they do in Edinburgh for good luck to usher in the new year. We'll also open a bottle of proper French champagne the way they teach you to do it in France. And we'll get you ready to visit Vatican City during the busy Jubilee Year festivities. Let's have some fun to start the hour making a snowman. Building figures out of snow is one of the earlier forms of art and expression in our world. Humorist and illustrator Bob Eckstein spent years investigating the history of the snowman and all things related to it. It made him into what must be the world's leading snowman expert. His book, The Illustrated History of the Snowman, is where he shares the stories, photos, and illustrations that tell the tale of snow figures from Father Winter in wartime Europe to Frosty on TV screens around the world. Bob Eckstein joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us how to better appreciate one of our oldest and coldest friends, the snowman. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm getting chills just thinking about talking about snowmen again.
Oh, man. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a celebrity who's crossed more international boundaries as universally as the snowman. Tell us about your obsession with, I think, what Europeans call snow puppets, right?
Yeah, but that's interesting that it is one of the most recognizable non-religious icons and symbols in the world. It really transforms at all different countries. It is a popular activity in Japan, throughout Europe, and even we even have a snowman made in the Sahara Desert. It is something everyone understands.
You know, in your book, you have a sort of a photo essay of snowmen around the world. You got a shot of 750 snowmen melting in Berlin to protest global warming. You've got a snowman in the window of a refrigerator. I think it was in Chicago. And a 60-foot tall snowman in China when somebody is placing a carrot on his nose from a crane. I mean, it's amazing. Around the world, you see this common character.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like the snowman is becoming the poster boy for global warming. The artwork that you referenced was actually a friend that I visited again in New York City. That installation traveled from the Art Institute of Chicago to the Met, where you could see it now. For people who are interested, you could see that refrigerated snowman. And of course, there's the whole metaphor and symbolism there. But the snowman making, I mean, is it something that man is going to one day never be able to do?
Ooh,
and it is something we can say.
That's a horrible thought. That's a sad thought because it's part of our childhood. I can't imagine a childhood without making a snowman.
Never mind childhood. It is one of the few activities that we kind of share with our ancestors. When I did the book, I had a dream team of experts because I was going into the project thinking I wanted to write a mystery, but I didn't want it to be like crime. So it could have been like who made the first sandwich or who told the first joke. Luckily, I picked who made the first snowman. But once I did, I collected experts in different fields, including Nigel Spivey, one of the world's leading archaeologists, who discussed with me the plausibility of prehistoric man making snowmen.
From your studies, what's the first record of some kind of a snowman?
First documentation, I believe, is northern China, early 7th century, when scriptures gave permission for people worshiping to be allowed to make snow Buddhas. And they would not have included that if such a thing didn't occur. I have actual physical evidence dating back to the 13th century in the margins of an illuminated manuscript of a book of ours next to a solemn passage of the crucifixion of Christ, in which a snowman is illustrated and is also insulting two religions at the same time because it's anti-Semitic.
But when you look at that snowman from, what, the 13th century, does it look like the kind of snowman a kid would crayon in his coloring book?
There's some similarities. It's clearly a snowman that's melting over a hot pot. And yes, it doesn't have the carrot. It doesn't have a top hat, which only came during the W.C. Fields years later. And we're still not sure whether it's W.C. Fields who stole the idea of that kind of image of a top hat or if it was the snowman. But yes, it's a snowman in this 13th century illuminated manuscript.
Now, you also have cases of other, like a snow festival in Brussels in the 1500s, where the lower class people actually made snow figures as part of the art of the people.
Yeah, well, at that time, in the medieval times, snowman making is not child's play. It was something that adults did as an activity. Not only did they make it as an activity, it was a form of entertainment where in the early evenings, couples would stroll through the town and see these snow scenes and would enjoy the creations made by other people.
It's fascinating to think that something that we just think of as Frosty the Snowman and stuff we see on TV or do in our backyard as we're kids, it does have that history. In fact, you mentioned even Michelangelo was talking about making a snowman.
He was commissioned to do one for a prince in Florence. The point is that Frosty actually hurt the art of snowman making because it made it seem as though it was for children, when in fact it's really for artists of all sorts. Famous artists have made snowmen, including people like one of our greatest American sculptors, Larkin Mead.
Bob Eckstein is the author of The Illustrated History of the Snowman. Bob's also written Footnotes from the Most Fascinating Museums and Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores. He shares cartoons and writing tips on Substack at The Bob and co-hosts a podcast called The Cartoon Pad. His website is bobeckstein.com. Bob, you wrote in your book that perhaps the most important snowman ever made was a colossal snow sculpture of a half-naked woman known as the Resistance, and that was in Paris in 1870. Explain to me how that could be such an important snowman.
This snowman was made by troops that happened to be a collection of France's top artists, and they were collected together, and they were getting bored during a lull in the battle, and the snow came down, and being artists as they are, they can't help themselves but to express themselves. It's like free art supplies dropped at their footsteps. And what they did was they created a snow museum made up of sculptures. This one piece became such an identifiable piece, it became a rally cry for the war. People got so inspired by it, it was documented, there was an engraving of it, and people tried to repeat it later in more permanent forms like marble and stuff, but it all came from a snow woman.
Okay, and that was in the 1800s in France. We also have historic snowmen or snow people from the United States in the 1800s. Tell us an example of a historic snowman from 200 years ago.
Well, it's actually the massacre of 1690, one of America's most bloodiest events of early history, in which they were about to be attacked by French Indians and soldiers that had been marching through the snow from Montreal. And as they approached the Fort Schenectady gates that were frozen open from the blizzard, they were greeted by two snowmen instead of two guards who had went inside to join the party at the pub inside the town.
So what happened?
Not good. Not good. It's one of the bloodiest events in American history. And
and
snowmen took a place in it. You know, it's another example of how sex and violence actually took place in the history of a snowman. And when I first started researching, I had no idea, but it had a lot of these crazy stories.
Hey, let's get into more modern times now and talk about advertising with the snowman and the snowman as a media star, as a movie star.
It started with advertising. Snowman was an easy pitch man in the 11th hour when you couldn't find a celebrity. The snowman could be used. And it actually was very popular with smoking and alcohol back in the 1920s and 30s,
smoking
before becoming
and
a movie star.
Okay, so the snowman is peddling booze and cigarettes. Yeah.
Well, he's always anywhere at the beginning of things. In other words, the first postcards often had snowmen. The first silent movies included snowmen. Some of the earliest photographs in the 1840s up in Scotland included a couple making a snowman. It seems like the snowman's always there at the advancement of technology.
I wonder why that is. It's just part of joy. I mean, how can you not be joyful?
The snowman's a reflection of ourselves. It's like man's first selfie. And it's easy to let the snowman stand in for ourselves and represent ourselves, which is why it's popular sometimes in protests. Snowmen are made in place of a human who might be fearful of doing it himself. We take out the snowman, we make him take the fall.
If there's anything that ever made the snowman actually beloved, I would say it's the pop hit Frosty the Snowman.
It is in this country, not in England. In England, it's the Raymond Briggs special for the holidays, The Snowman, in which there's no dialogue and it's a snowman flying. That's beloved by the country. People don't know Frosty, I think, outside of America. But in America, it all began with a short little animated thing and a Gene Autry song. He would later go on to write Peter Cottontail. I think he just thought that he was onto something there with these gimmick songs. And this was all based on a children's book. But I always contend that this is the downfall of snowman being dignified and graceful and being considered a serious art form.
Oh, so I get it. So that's just cheapening it. All right. Well, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been brightening up our holiday season with a talk with Bob Eckstein. His book is The Illustrated History of the Snowman. And Bob, I never thought I would be so pulled in to the story and the history of that snowman that's been a part of all of our lives. You have a lot of interesting little factoids in the book, and one of them that I think is just really thought-provoking, and I'm just going to read it and see if it'll give you a final word. It takes 10 million snowflakes to make a snowman.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most romantic things you could do. If you think about going on a date, make a snowman.
And you're putting 10 million snowflakes together.
No one's counting. We're not counting.
And something that you can decorate together, and one day it'll melt away, but it'll stay in your minds as a memory you've created together.
And
forever.
The point is, don't make it with our homemade objects. Make it for yourself. Don't get an inflatable snowman or a pre-made snowman. This is a tactile activity that we all can enjoy that we've kind of forgotten about.
Wow. Bob Eckstein, you are evangelical about the snowman. Thanks so much for your book, and happy holidays.
Grab your mittens, Rick. We're going to go make a snowman.
All right. We'll hear why it's a big year ahead in Vatican City in just a minute. And we'll help you greet the new year with a bit of bubbly and a wee dram, too. Stay with us. It's Travel with Rick Steves.
This is a blessing, very powerful blessing from a Bulgarian heart and Bulgarian soul. And get ready for some Bulgarian. Surva, surva godina, vesela godina, червена ябълка в градина, златен клас на нива, пълна къща със сланина и куприна, живот и здраве до година, до амина. Амин.
Amen. And what did you say in English?
And I said roughly the following. Let this year be very fruitful. Let we have red apples on the trees. Let we have golden wheat in the fields. Silk and bacon in our home. But let us all be very healthy. Be healthy.
Stefan Bozadjev from Bulgaria. Blagodaria.
Blagodaria. Thank you, Rick.
The world's smallest country is big on the wish list of many travelers from all over the globe. The Vatican City, while tiny in acreage, is the spiritual capital of 1 billion Roman Catholics worldwide. And in about 100 acres, it packs some of the most significant sites of the Christian world. Be warned, people who visit without a plan might think that Rome's nickname as the Eternal City actually refers to the wait in line for the visiting of the Sistine Chapel. But if you're well-organized, it can be a beautiful experience. Now, for the latest in visiting both the Basilica of St. Peter and the amazing Vatican Museum with the Sistine Chapel, we're joined today by tour guides Nina Bernardo and Susanna Perrocchini. Nina and Susanna, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for
asking us to be part of this. It's nice to be here, Rick.
What a delight to be able to have both of you here in our studio, and you guys essentially earn your living in Rome, taking groups around to see all of the wonders of culture that Rome has to offer, and a big part of that is the Vatican. Nina, when you think about the Vatican, as I said, it's a little country. What are the dimensions of what you'll see as a visitor?
Well, when you go there, you're going to see a cluster of buildings that's surrounded by some walls. And inside those walls is about 109 acres, so not very big. And the main things that you want to see in there are obviously St. Peter's Basilica and then the Vatican Museums. So the Vatican Museums are some of the largest museums in all of the world, with over 50 galleries filled with art.
And you've got this wall, which is impressive. It's a formidable wall.
It is a formidable
wall. I mean, it was real back when it was an independent country surrounded by enemies. They needed this wall.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's even the escape path, that
right, the secret passageway. Yeah, so the Pope could get out.
But you have the biggest church in Christendom in many measures, and you've got, of course, the great museum. And you can't just... Generally, the tourists have to walk literally around the country to get to the Vatican Museum.
Exactly.
And then you've got a beautiful square in front of the Basilica.
Right. With this
Piazza San Pietro.
Piazza San Pietro, right. And from there, you've got this view all the way down to the river and Castel Sant'Angelo.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So the first stop for most people, I would think, is the Basilica. And the Basilica is either a touristic attraction or it's the destination of pilgrims. Now, as a tour guide, how do you prepare your travelers to respect the Vatican as they visit this greatest church in Christendom?
Well, first of all, they have to respect a very strict dress code.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to have their shoulders and knees covered. And that is important because it might be a silly thing to add, but they check, especially if they go in the good season, with the weather that is so hot, they are going to be checked one by one. So they have to pass through security. The second thing is to remind people that is the holy place, one of the holiest of all places in Christendom. So they have to be respectful. And the fact that they have to be online sometimes for, let's say, half an hour to an hour, sometimes under the sun, under the rain, it doesn't make it less holy.
That's right. And you're standing in line not to give money, but you're standing in line for security.
Exactly.
So you stand in line, and if you want to miss that, you can go very early or very late.
Yes, I would suggest always the very early.
I would suggest skipping breakfast almost and getting there crack of dawn. It's open early for worship, and if you go in a worshipful way, you can go right through security, and you are in beautiful tranquility in that greatest church.
That is absolutely the best moment to go in there, because understanding then the space and the scale on you with not thousands of other people in there is just a wow moment for sure.
And then I always think it's important to not look at it through the sensibilities of 21st century perspective and practicality and so on, but put yourself back 500 years. This was the most glorious building people in Europe could build to praise God. And that's what they wanted to do. And if you see it on those terms, it really can be mind-boggling. And I think from a tourism point of view, it's important to put yourself in a respectful Roman Catholic frame of mind rather than looking at it from a cynical kind of way, and to enjoy it on its terms. Nina, what are some of the highlights for you as a teacher and a tour guide when you take people through St. Peter's?
The first thing that comes to mind is obviously Michelangelo's Pietà, which when you walk through the door is right there to your right. It's behind bulletproof glass, but it is nonetheless an amazing work of art. And so just if you go early, you actually get to stand right in front of it.
Yeah.
And when you think about how young he was when he sculpted something that's so full of emotion, it's amazing. And then I think second for me would definitely be the baldacchino, so the canopy, the bronze canopy that's over the altar. And then you stand under there and you understand the scale of this, and you're underneath that dome that's kind of lifting you up to the light.
And you're looking up there at this glorious dome with the sun rays streaming through, and you realize that was the tallest dome that had ever been built at that time, taller than a football field on end, designed by Michelangelo.
Yes.
And you got that baldacchino that kind of connects it with the altar, which is right above St. Peter's tomb. And people have been worshiping there for nearly 2,000 years. I mean, to give people a little sense of the spiritual gravitas of that is really something.
Well, this is exactly the experience that they wanted you to have, is to have this mystical experience with the divine through the art.
Yeah.
And when you walk in there, you say, wow, and you have this emotional response to it.
And ahead, you're right there at St. Peter's tomb. So St. Peter is down below you and above you in 6-foot-tall letters in the mosaics on the edge of the dome. It says in Latin, "Tu es Petrus, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church."
as if the Roman Catholic Church had to make a reminder of what is the primacy of Peter in their brand of Christianity. You know,
yes.
It was said that the church on earth will be built upon St. Peter, and this literally is. And then you look up at the altar in the apse, and you see it's called the cathedra.
The cathedra.
Yeah. The chair of the bishop.
Yes.
And to think the Pope was the first bishop.
Yeah.
That goes all the way back to Peter. And then you got those alabaster starburst.
Yeah. It's amazing when the rays of light are coming in there.
Instead of having normal glass, they just sliced alabaster really thin. Now, of all the virtues to consider when visiting Vatican City, patience may be the most important one, as our tour guides Susanna Perucchini and Nina Bernardo remind us right now on Travel with Rick Steves. They're helping us plan a visit to St. Peter's Basilica and the Vatican Museums during the busy Jubilee year of 2025 that Pope Francis declared. We have links to our guests with the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Now, I think it's kind of funny because there's two different kind of tourists or visitors. You know, there's tourists that are just going to get a selfie, and there are people that are going there because they're going to worship there. There's sort of a balcony up towards the apse, and you can go past that if you're going to, quote, worship. You don't have to be a Christian to go through that. You can go up there and you can sit down and you can attend a mass respectfully. And that gives you a whole different sensibility of the experience, I would say.
Absolutely, it does. And then it's also interesting to watch the people who are obviously there for religious reasons. They're there for spiritual reasons. Or you see the nuns and the priests who are there from all corners of the earth, and you know they've come there to make their pilgrimage.
Now, as a tourist, you can go to the top of the dome. And that is quite an experience.
It is.
Have you been to the top?
Yes, I've been a couple of times. And actually, I always say to people, if you have to go, put yourself in line early.
Yeah.
You have to pay a ticket to go there.
Yeah.
And actually, you have a little bit of a discount if you're willing to go all the way up by steps without using the elevator, because the elevator will take you till a certain point, and then inevitably,
still lots more.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can go to the roof of the nave with the elevator, and then you have to climb the stairs up that big dome.
Exactly.
And you go between the dome, because Michelangelo designed a dome
within
a dome.
You're going between the shells, right?
So you're between the shells, and you almost have to bend to your right as you arc up the spiral staircase. It's a long way up, and you get this. One of the highlights for me is the railing where you look out over the church from high above. And you see the little tiny people just buzzing around down there, and you can just feel like,
yes, us little
years.
Ants. Yes,
they built this 500 years ago, and then you get to the very top and you pop out. And Nina, you've just got an incredible view. What do you see?
No, it's amazing. You can see all of Rome down towards the river, so you get the sense of Bernini's Piazza and then Castel Sant'Angelo in the distance, and
wow.
It's a fantastic view. Absolutely.
So if you have the time and the energy and the endurance, it's really exciting.
I would say that's a highlight moment.
I don't go to a lot of top of spires these days, you know, but that's one that I go to. It's really worth it. It's really, really good. And then you can also go down into the crypt. And that's so many important popes from long ago are buried. So lots of stuff to see and experience in the Basilica. But then everybody wants to go to the Vatican Museums. And that's plural because it's a collection of different museums. And you walk around the country. If you don't have a reservation in advance, you're going to waste hours and you're going to get sunburned. You just got to get a reservation in advance. You can't do that for the Basilica. You just wait in line for the security and go early to make it minimal or late. But for the Vatican Museum, it's tough. Get a timed entry, and then you get in and it's all yours. And Nina, there's kind of a stampede route, right? Most people just do sort of the predictable thing.
Right. Most people walk down the straight galleries that take them sometimes with the shortcut or sometimes the long way to the Sistine Chapel. A lot of people who go there only want to see the Sistine Chapel and are maybe not interested in everything
else.
At
a minimum, if that's you, wait a minute. Hold on. You got to see the ancient Greek and Roman statues.
Yes.
You got to see the Grand Hall with all the maps.
Right.
You should take a look at the modern Christian art, I think. Maybe not. Okay, that would be stretching it. But you got to go to the Raphael rooms, which are amazing. And then the finale would be the Sistine Chapel. Now, that's what probably 80% of the tourists do, just exactly what we laid out there. You could take that away, and it would still be a world-class museum. What would you have beyond that, Susanna?
Well, you know, for me, one of the things that people visit the less, and it's understandable in a way, is the Egyptian and Etruscan part, which is very interesting because Egyptians people were interesting people of the past, and Etruscans, they're our ancestors.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have to think that out of the seven kings of Rome, I believe that three or four, they were from...
Rome was originally an Etruscan town.
Exactly. So what I'm trying to say here is that there is so much, and I understand that the time and the energy is limited, but I think that we should try, and even though you don't have the energy to do that, try to do a little peek in the Pinacoteca. Very few people go there.
I was wondering, Nina, how did the Vatican amass such an amazing collection of art?
That's a really important point to make, because people forget that this started out as the private collection of the Pope, who at the time was the monarch of Rome. So this is a private monarch's collection that in the beginning was shown to very few. So VIPs would come to see the Pope and he would show them his collection. And it started all during the time of the Renaissance, when Rome was getting a facelift and they were digging for foundations of buildings and finding this ancient Roman sculptures. And here was a place to display it.
And the Pope gets it. And
right.
He gets a lot of gifts from people that want to win his favor.
Exactly. And so the collections have grown and grown.
And you'll see the obvious stuff. You'll see the Pinacoteca, like Susanna mentioned, the painting gallery. Downstairs, next to the cafeteria, is a carriage museum for the Pope's carriages over the centuries. And that's been really interesting. The ancient Roman Christian art. A lot of people don't realize that 200 years of ancient Rome was Christian. There's wonderful Christian art from the 300s and 400s. And there's so much more that you can see at the Vatican Museum. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about visiting the Vatican with two Rome guides. We're joined by Nina Bernardo and Susanna Perucchini. You know, Nina, 2025 is the every 25 years festival year in the Catholic Church, the Jubilee year declared by the Pope. What does that mean for the faithful, and what does it mean for people who want to visit Rome during a Jubilee year?
So for the faithful, knowing that it's coming up, they've been preparing for a long time, because every 25 years, maybe once in their life, they're going to have a chance to make this pilgrimage. And if they come to Rome and are truly repentant of their sins and they walk through one of the holy doors, then they will be forgiven of their sins. So for some people, this is truly a spiritual event, and they've been planning a long time to come. Rome is going to get a lot more visitors, and other people who are coming to Rome for other reasons are going to be there. So it's going to be incredibly crowded all throughout this year.
So let's talk about crowds just in general, because Rome is one of these cities in Europe that is over-touristed, and everybody wants to go at the same time. They want to avoid the heat of the summer, and they don't go in the dead of winter, so they go in the spring or the fall, and they want to go to the same five or six sites, and these can be quite crowded. What is a good strategy you have for helping tourists manage the crowds, Susanna?
Well, I would say, since many, many people will be there, to try to be early or, whenever possible, a little bit later. So if we're talking about, for example, museums, you know, and some museums, such as you just mentioned, you know, the Vatican Museums, you need to have a reservation. You can even decide to book one of the later of the day, like I believe that till 5 is the 5 p.m., the last entrance, and that would give you 2 good hours.
Yeah. Nina and Susanna, there's so many dimensions of the Vatican, and you guys have gone there so many times. What is one little angle on the Vatican that you just get the most joy out of sharing as a guide?
Well, I would say when we are outdoor and we cross the Pinecone courtyard, that it's an open space, has the ancient Pinecone. So this pine cone, which is 12 feet big, tall, used to be one of the decorations. We don't know exactly what it was decorating, but it's a symbol of fertility. You know, you have lots of seeds inside. And so it was always considered a symbol of fertility on the other side.
Way back in ancient times.
Way back in ancient Roman times.
And it looks like it's made out of gold. I mean, it's quite striking.
It is striking. And on the opposite side, in the middle of the courtyard, you have this contemporary art rotating sphere by Pomodoro. So you can see the two sides of the coin, the contemporary art and the ancient art, in the same space.
I love that. A reminder that you've got that ancient foundation and the living institution today.
Absolutely.
I suppose there's no accident they put them together. Nina, how about you as a tour guide? What do you particularly enjoy giving to your guests?
I'm going to piggyback on that, because I also love this combination of ancient and modern, but it's the modern art gallery in the Vatican Museums, and it's the place people are so tired by then. They blow through it to get to the Sistine Chapel. But if you just go off, you can be all by yourself in front of a Dali
or Francis Bacon. And if you look above, you have ceilings that have been painted by Pinturicchio 500 years ago. So you've got this wonderful combination and all to yourself.
And as you said, you're at a point where everybody's exhausted and the sign says, direct to the Sistine or to the Sistine through many halls of modern Christian art. And not many people are going to go to the modern art, but it is worthwhile. And it is fun to look at all of these painters that you've thought of in modern art terms and see what their association with
with religious art.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Let's finish our discussion just for a couple minutes talking about great sites in Rome that would make Rome great for a visit, even if we didn't go to the Colosseum and the Forum and the Vatican.
Nina. So I think if you want something papal palace related, the Galleria Doria Pamphili or the Palazzo Barberini. Pamphili and Barberini were two papal families. They each produced a pope, and so they have these wonderful palaces filled with art. Almost nobody there.
So Doria Pamphili, and that's right in, right in front of the Victor Emanuele.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Right in the Corso. It's
so
like you're going to walk right by it. And it is a wonderful aristocratic palace.
Exactly.
And the Lord
and the Pamphili family
is
still around.
Mr. Pamphili made the audio guide, and he takes you on a personal walk through it. I just was there, and I just love that audio guide. And then the
Palazzo Barberini, which is not far from the Trevi Fountain.
Uh-huh.
And it's got another amazing collection of art. It's got a Caravaggio and a Raphael.
Uh-huh.
And the Palazzo was designed by some of the most important architects of the Baroque era.
So important when we're going to Rome to have the help of somebody else's experience. You guys are great. Thank you so much for helping us understand the Vatican and the challenges of visiting Rome. Nina Bernardo and Susanna Pertacchini, buon lavoro.
Grazie.
Grazie.
There's a simple technique for opening a bottle of champagne so you don't make a mess or frighten the cat. Guides from France join us to tell us how, and we'll revisit our favorite Scottish traditions for greeting the new year. It's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. The region of France that gives champagne its name sparkles with possibilities for travelers. To help us plan a trip to the Champagne region of France and to provide pointers for enjoying the good stuff, we're joined now by tour guides Julie Sanvaux and Virginie Moret. Bonjour, mes amis.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
So champagne, what do you think about when I say the word champagne?
Parties, celebration, friends.
Okay.
Bubbles, effervescence.
And if you're looking at a map and you say champagne, what do you think about?
Eastern France, northeastern France.
One of the most northern regions where they grow wine.
And it really is synonymous with the beloved bubbly wine. Now, they must work hard to protect the image of champagne because everybody produces this kind of wine, and a lot of people call it champagne, but the people of Champagne try to say it's only us that can call it that.
I lived for 10 years in the U.S., and when people were saying, I'm bringing champagne, I would be like, this is Californian sparkling wine, but it's... You know, it's branding. It's what we call the terroir in France. You know, wines from Champagne, they have to come from there and they have to follow methods, you know,
for making
that exactly to be called Champagne.
So there are bubbly, sparkling wines from other parts of France that are not called Champagne?
What are they called? We have the Crémant d'Alsace, Crémant de la Loire, Clairette de Die. So pretty much every region of France where they make
Claret,
wine.
Claret, I would pronounce it as an American Claret. That's a bubbly wine?
Not the same Claret as what was exported to England.
Okay, that's
a
different...
Claret, yes. Claret.
But that word is used for the bubbly. And
yes.
Then Crémant.
Crémant.
Sometimes they call it Mousseux.
And in Italy?
Prosecco.
Prosecco.
Yeah.
Spain.
Cava. The same methods of making champagne, but you can't even call it méthode champenoise, but you have to call it traditional methods of making bubbly wine.
Okay.
Even Yves Saint Laurent, I think it was Yves Saint Laurent back in the 90s, he tried to make a perfume which was shaped like the cork. Yeah. The bottle was shaped like the cork of champagne, and he called it champagne, and there was a lawsuit. No, you couldn't call it champagne.
So they really are serious about that. They defend it.
Yes.
Now, it goes way back historically.
Right.
Champagne was invented in Epernay, right? In Champagne country.
Yeah, and what they had to go through historically to defend the vineyards and to defend the champagne and to sell it, because it was so difficult to produce it and to export it because of the bottles and the bubbles and the... It would go bad very easily. And so they worked so hard to make it what it is that they deserve it. They deserve the name.
Sure, and they wanted to protect the quality. If somebody makes some second-rate stuff and calls it champagne, it's not going to be good for your for your brand.
And it's a pretty recent wine that we have because originally, as Julie mentioned, it was very north, so it's very hard to get good quality wine. And they were competing for the steel wine with the Burgundy wines, which are known to be better. So after the accident of the monk Dom Pérignon, of finding out that with a second fermentation, you could keep the bubble in the wine, you know, it took a few centuries before finally, when we get train transportation and the glassmaker are getting better at making glass that would not break.
Okay, because
then
the champagne bottle has a reinforced bottom, doesn't it? Because there's so much power packed in
and
here.
And the glass
it just
is
wants
thicker.
To pop. When I open a wine bottle, it doesn't pop out. But when I open a champagne bottle, of course, it pops. Is that because of the second fermentation?
Yes, the pressure that you actually have in the bottle.
So explain just in very easy terms, what is champagne? I mean, how do they make it?
So to make wine, you need fermentation.
So you need to ferment the grape juice.
Yes, you need sugar to become alcohol. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that in still wine, you want to prevent a second fermentation. Mm-hmm. But in champagne, you actually want to trigger it.
And how do they do that?
So they add yeast and sugar, which in France, you can't add anything to the wine unless you're doing champagne. And that's what you want to do that. And so you're going to create a second fermentation, which will happen this time not in the barrel or the stainless steel, you know, vat, but in the bottle.
In the bottle.
Which you cap with a beer cap and that you turn upside down.
So this is quite labor intensive then on this upside down part.
It used to be very labor intensive.
Because I've seen those racks and, and you know, they say every day they have to turn it a little bit.
A quarter turn.
What's the purpose of that?
It's called riddling. And the purpose is when they put the yeast in it, when it dies, it kind of sticks to the side of the bottle. And they need to get it up into the neck of the bottle, so then they can pop that bottle cap off, and the pressure will push the yeast out. Then they just fill it back up with a little bit of wine or sometimes
some
sugar.
Some liqueur or something.
Sometimes brandy.
But it takes a while for the sediment to slowly spin
little
down.
Little by little, it slides.
So eventually,
down.
You've spun it over time, and it's all the impurities are at the near the cap. Mm. And then do they freeze it?
So they have to freeze it. And it's interesting to see how it's made by hand because originally there was no machine. Nowadays it's made with machine. But the people who were, you know, making what we call the dégorgement, disgorging, I assume you call it in English, they had to be super fast. They had to freeze it, pop it out, and then add the sweet stuff that gives it the
personality or the wine. Yeah.
Or sugar also if you wanted it sweeter.
And that would give the personality to this or that wine. I would think that little extra you add and then you cap it.
Mm-hmm. With the real, you know, cork this time.
Yeah, the famous cork.
And that process is called riddling when they turn them. And a riddler, a good riddler, can turn about 60,000 bottles a day.
A riddler. Mm-hmm. So two hands going through, turn.
And those racks that,
And then the bottle goes steeper and steeper and steeper, and eventually it's ready to...
And Rick is doing this with his bottle, so when he opens it, it's going to explode.
Well, let's do this. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Virginie Morier and Julie Sanvo. We're talking champagne, which can only be called champagne if it's from Champagne country, 2 hours away from Paris by TGV train, I believe. And the big city is Reims. R-E-I-M-S. This is one of those towns that are hard to pronounce. It sort of rhymes with France.
Yes.
But it's spelled like Reims. The average traveler would look at that and go, Reims, but it's Reims. Virginie, you've got a wonderful ability to say it. How would you say it in French?
Reims.
Reims.
And then you have to pronounce the S at the end, which usually we don't. We don't say Paris, we say Paris.
Right.
But we say Reims, so it's the exception.
It's the exception. And Julie, you have lived in France for a long time, but you grew up in America. Let's hear you say it.
Reims. I roll it a little bit more.
That's
house.
Good. And then champagne is from many different caves. And Reims, if you're touring, you can go to Epernay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the famous, the legendary discovery. The monk accidentally fermented his wine twice. And he goes running down the halls. Brothers, he's in the abbey. I still picture this one 1,000 years ago. Brothers, brothers, come quickly. I'm drinking stars. So that would be a great day for champagne lovers. And shall we have a little bit?
Oh, yes, of course.
Never say no to champagne.
Oh, I didn't need to sell you on that. So this is, I just love this. You know, it's sort of a tradition, isn't it? I mean, it's a ritual, I mean.
It is a ritual opening. And even when you start to open that, if you'll notice, you always undo the wire cage, you turn it 7 times.
You do.
It's twisted 7 times.
So I'm going to do this now, and I was demonstrating the spinning thing, so we don't know how energized this is going to be. But I'm going to spin it 7 times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7. You got it.
Magic number.
Well, I didn't realize that. All my life I've been popping that. These things.
And you're not at the Tour de France, so you're not going to spill.
So I take
most
a little, this is like a dog's muzzle. I take that off.
People collect those, the top.
Now I'm going to walk me through this. We're going
to. Well, what you want to do is you want to hold the cork.
Yeah.
And you want to twist the bottle. You don't twist the cork, you twist the bottle.
Is that a
and
tradition?
And you hold it at an angle.
Yeah.
And that way it shouldn't explode.
Okay.
But you
a little bit more of an angle.
More of an angle?
You shook it several times.
So
before.
I'm holding it at a 45-degree angle, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm going to hold
the
corks
bottle.
And I'm turning the bottle.
Yes.
And then?
And what you really want to do is just make it burp. You want to make it sigh.
Well,
you don't
want to
make it,
it
pop.
To, it's not like after a football game and you're going to lose all
no,
your
No, we do that and it's fun and that's okay. But they do it. When they do it, it just goes psst.
Oh, so I'm going to let it, like, I'm going to burp the baby. Kinda.
Right.
Okay, ready?
Yeah. Nice. And it good.
Oh, and it's
wow.
got that beautiful,
yeah, he didn't spill a drop.
That beautiful steam. It's like, oh,
he didn't
baby.
Waste a drop.
And I must oh, pour you some. No, is there any trick to pouring it? Do I hold
you
the glass
can
a certain way?
Hold the glass at an angle so you're not going to have foam.
Oh, so you minimize the foam by holding it at an angle.
Yeah.
And I poured about
Merci.
All these.
Usually, this is actually the only wine in France where you go to the top of the glass. Other wines, you never want to have a full glass because then you don't have room to swirl it. But on the champagne, usually you
go
can
to the
fill
top.
The top. Here we go.
Oh, that
Lucky
sounds
Julie.
Lovely.
Ooh la la.
Thank you for telling him that for my glass. I appreciate that.
I love that.
That.
Now, let's just listen for a minute. I like this. Okay, ready? And it sort of, my cup runneth over, but it does not
perfect.
Spill.
It was perfect. It was perfect. You got that foam to go up there, but not over the edge.
And then you've got these bubblies. I mean, it just makes you feel festive.
It does.
Exactly. It's like something great happened. And then what do we say?
Santé.
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 To your health.
À la vôtre.
À la vôtre.
À la vôtre.
Mm-hmm. Life is good.
Pas mal, as the French do say.
Not
bad.
I like that. Pas mal. Not bad. Mm. It's great to be drinking champagne right here, I got to tell you. But let's say you're traveling around France and you want to have a little more background on this champagne before you actually drink it. You can go to Reims and go to the famous champagne caves. And there's hundreds of champagne caves. A lot of them are open to the public. What is the process for going to... I like Reims because you can get there from Paris easily. It's got a great cathedral with amazing history. It was the place for royal coronations, what 26 kings were crowned there in France, I believe, going all the way back to Clovis 1,500 years ago. Incredible sound and light show.
Yes.
It's laser lighting and this glorious lighting, and you can actually inhabit it with workers and kings and coronations and tell the whole story on the facade. Mm-hmm. And people gather after dark, and you sit there in the park in front of the cathedral. And it comes to light with all these lasers and great sound. And it's brilliant.
It transforms it. It's jaw-dropping.
In Reims, that's one place where you really want to remember to do that because that's,
definitely.
I think, one of the best in France. And then also World War II, 1945. The war was finished and Eisenhower and the Allies accepted the unconditional surrender of the German forces right there. And it's an amazing little museum if you're interested in that
history.
The
surrender museum. It's left just as it was when they signed.
I love it. And then you can go, after you've done your history now and
right.
your art, you can go out to the champagne caves. Let's just say you're going to go to Tatinger. That's one of the champagne caves that are available for the public there. What's the experience?
So you go to Tatinger. It's better to have a reservation. They do a different group, you know, timing. And then you're going to go down into the cellar. So you're not going to have an elevator. You do have to use your legs. This is before the tasting.
Oh, yeah.
So the
down
tasting
into
is
the
after.
Cellar, that would be a series of caves deep down in that kept the temperature the same all the time.
Exactly. We call them crayères. So it's kind of a chalky stone that we have there. And you're going to see some of them date back from the Roman time. Most of them will be from the 14th, 15th century. And they explain to you how they make champagne. They show you the riddling, the old method. And then you would finish by tasting one, two, three, or four of their champagne.
Tasting?
Absolutely.
Did somebody say tasting?
Did somebody say tasting?
Oh, that's my kind of tour. Here's to champagne.
Santé.
Wow. French culture. You can drink it.
And this is a Brut. You had a Brut. Now, we have several type of
You can tell
champagne.
That just by tasting.
Yeah, it's drier.
Tasted wet.
We have Brut and Sec. Sec means dry, but it's the sweetest. So the Brut is the champagne that is going to have the less amount of sugar added. Now, in the old times, they used to add way more sugar than they do now, but they have to add some of the sugar. And so you want a brut when you have it as a aperitif, like we're having now.
Right.
Because if it's too sweet, it's just, you know, that's not something that you want to have before dinner. Mm. And then if you have champagne with dessert, then maybe you want something sweeter.
So you look for the word, this says brut. Or sec. Mm-hmm. So,
or demi-sec, which is halfway through.
Okay. So, and but if you're doing it to enjoy the flavor of the champagne without something sweet to eat with it, you'd probably have brut.
Mm-hmm. And now they're making rosé champagnes.
That are very festif.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the difference with, you know, champagne and other wines is that you don't have a vintage on every bottle because it's actually a blend. This is a region of France which is very north for growing vines. And so it's not consistent. So they have the right to blend different years. If you have a year on a bottle, it means it comes from only 1 year. But those are exceptional years.
Okay.
And they're going to be more expensive.
So it's better to blend it.
It's the way they've been making it because they don't have the production that they would have other places.
As we're learning right now on Travel with Rick Steves, champagne is so much more than just tiny bubbles in your wine. The Champagne region itself in the northeast of France is a great destination to explore. Our guides are Virginie Moret, who lives in Lyon, and American-born Julie Sanvaux, who's lived in Burgundy for many years. So I'm starting to feel this champagne, but can you teach me just a French, like what you would say when you're having a good time together, more than santé, what would you say?
If you want to be formal, you say à la vôtre. That means votre santé, to your health. Or you can say just santé. Where I live in the countryside in France, we say chin-chin.
Chin-chin, yeah, we do the same.
Chin-chin.
And then is there some sort of a blessing you give to people? May you live...
santé means... to your health.
Yeah.
So it's the more you drink, the more you have santé, the healthier you are.
The healthier you get. All right. And we're going to enjoy French culture with the help of our better understanding of champagne. Virginie Moret and Julie Sanvaux, I would like to drink to you. And thank
Merci.
You very much for
santé.
A lesson and a beautiful slice of French culture. A votre santé.
Oh, there's one thing. You have to look at the person
in the eye
when you're...
Always.
Always.
Very nice. Merci bien.
Merci.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
The creative Celtic spirit is in full bloom as the three-day Hogmanay Street Party in Edinburgh makes it one of Europe's biggest festivals for New Year's, complete with what's said to be the biggest midnight fireworks display in the world. Whether you like crazy crowds or prefer a more intimate observance at home, Anne Doig and Ken Hanley are here to tell us why Edinburgh, Scotland is a grand place to welcome in the new year. Anne and Ken, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us, Rick.
Are you looking forward to New Year's in Edinburgh?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
How do you celebrate New Year's Eve in Edinburgh?
Very traditionally. I know we have what's said to be the biggest street party in the world, but, you know, if you're going for tradition, which I still do and Anne still does, then you make sure the house is clean. So the house, in other words, has got to be clean. And you make sure that you've got enough drink for your friends and things like that. People go first footing. And to go first footing properly, you have to have a piece of black coal, a wee piece of cake, and a wee bottle of whiskey.
What's first footing?
It goes, you go to friends, you just tap
a
door.
You go visiting, and they're not going to turn you away.
Absolutely not. And I think if your first footer, traditionally in Scotland, is tall, dark, and handsome, that means that you're going to have a year of good luck.
It's quite interesting. It has to be dark. And I wonder if anyone knows why it has to be a dark person, dark hair. It dates back to the attacks by the Vikings, the blonde, tall Vikings. If you were blonde, you might be a threat. So it had to be a dark person. And you open at the strike of midnight, you open your front door and rush through and open the back door. So you're welcoming in the new year and letting the old year out. So there's all these traditions that we adhere to.
Wow. Now, is there something that is like a countdown in Edinburgh?
It's fireworks, really. There's a big street party, you see, so they'll be counting down on the stage. There are entertainers and bands playing. And then all of a sudden, there's an explosion of fireworks over Edinburgh Castle.
But then you get down with your neighbours and you open your front door?
Absolutely.
And you open the back door?
Yes.
Total strangers can turn up at your door and everyone's welcome. And they come in and you offer a drink, you offer a piece of cake, you have a wee blether, you know, and then you move along. And
a wee blether is a
wee
little
blether is a little talk.
Have a wee blether.
And it then sort of gets known in the community who's got open house. That's what happens.
Okay.
And if you've got open house, then everyone piles in to visit you.
If you're in Scotland on New Year's Eve, it's just like one big open house. People are on the streets. They've got their coal and their drink and their cake, and they're going to knock on a stranger's door and celebrate the new year.
Absolutely.
We all sing Auld Lang Syne.
Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah, we do.
That's Scottish, isn't it?
Yes. Robert Burns.
That's Robert Burns. What does that mean, Auld Lang Syne?
For the sake of Auld Lang Syne. A lot of different interpretations. I would say for old friends. Remembering.
Remembering.
Friends for friendship's sake.
And you know the song. Sing the song for me.
It's old sentimental. Song, you know.
Acquaintance
be forgot and never brought to mind. Should old acquaintance be forgot for the sake of Auld Lang Syne. Now, here's the hand, my trusty friend, and here's the hand, oh mine. And it goes on. And
you're all holding hands.
It's this inbuilt thing in the Scots that, you know, it's been great to see you. We don't want to see you go, but because you're going away, for the sake of Auld Lang Syne, keep that memory, keep everything, that heartfelt thing.
So that's the punchline of the lyric is, for the sake of
Auld Lang Syne.
The old sake of old times. Yeah.
Yes.
For the sake of Auld Lang Syne, Happy New Year.
And happy New Year.
All the best to you. Happy New Year, Rick Boyd.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton,
Donna Bardsley,
and Casmeral Hall.
Website uploads are by Sherry Quirt and Andrew Wakeling.
Promotion support comes from Sheila Gerzoff, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank.
You'll find more at ricksteves.com/radio.
Wishing you warm and healthy holidays
from all of us at Travel with Rick Steves.